produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and coffee bar.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. His name is Stephen Shaw. He's also known as the Fat Guy. A food critic, Shaw is the founder of the website eGullet. He's also the author of a new book about restaurants, Turning the Tables, Restaurants from the Inside Out. One of his goals in writing the book: if we have a better understanding of how restaurants work, we can also learn how better to enjoy dining in them. This afternoon, with Stephen Shaw as our guide, we'll go behind the scenes of eateries, from hot dog stands to haute cuisine. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments about dining out for Stephen Shaw. You can join the conversation with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Are you outside our local dialing area? You can call us toll-free. The toll-free number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest, Stephen Shaw. He is a James Beard Award-winning food critic and a contributor to many magazines and journals. His interest in food goes back to his childhood, when he and his dad sat at the counter at the neighborhood diner. This, he notes, was three decades before the current restaurant architecture trend of open kitchen design, and cooking shows, even a network devoted to food, were everywhere on television. Stephen Shaw's book, Turning the Tables, Restaurants from the Inside Out, is published by HarperCollins. You'll find the website he founded, eGullet, at www.egullet.org. And connected with that website is an online cooking school, the eGullet Culinary Institute. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Stephen, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Hi, Celeste.
Hi. Tell us about those outings with your dad to the local diner.
Oh, well, it was great. You know, it was a ritual we did every weekend. We went to the local diner up on Columbus Avenue in New York City, and we would sit at the counter, and we would watch the guy at the grill, and my father would narrate what was going on. So as the guy would be cooking the potatoes, my father would be commenting on the guy's potato technique. And as he would be, there would be always banter between the grill man and the customers, and my father would always inject himself into it. So one time we were there, and a little old lady ordered liver and onions, and she said to the grill man, "Cut it up in little pieces." And the grill man says, "Cut it up in little pieces." And my father, of course, says, "Cut it up in little pieces." So, you know, these things all became inside jokes that lasted us my father's whole life.
Yeah, yeah. And then you began cooking in high school, cooking for your friends on the debating team. What were your specialties at the time?
Well, I actually got a book. By the time I was in high school, my father was pretty sick, and my mother was devoting most of her time to caring for him. So I had to be somewhat independent, especially about routine things like cooking dinner. So my mother was always a great cook, but she just didn't have time when I was 16, 17 years old. So I bought this book at the local bookstore called The Teenage Chef. And it had all these recipes in it for chili was a big thing that I cooked all the time, and French onion soup. And I also made a lot of breakfast food, because that was what my father had always taught me to make. But I'd make it at dinner time, too. So my friends had pancakes for dinner all the time. We loved that.
Yeah. Did you ever consider becoming a chef?
Well, the few times I toyed with it, I was rapidly deterred by how hard the work is.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I don't mind working all hours. It's just not for me. One restaurant, we're standing up.
You know, Stephen, we're essentially losing you here, our phone connection. So what we're going to do, I think, is we're going to reestablish this phone connection so that we don't miss anything that you're saying, okay?
Okay.
Stephen Shaw will be back with us in just a moment. Hope you'll stay with us, bear with us. Stephen Shaw, author of Turning the Tables, Restaurants from the Inside Out. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Coming up later this afternoon on The World from PRI, another food topic, Chef Peggy Knickerbocker brings Parisian flair to America's homegrown holiday. Thanksgiving suggestions from the author of Simple Soirees. That and the day's news coming up today on The World. That gets underway at 3 o'clock Central Time. You can hear the program again with updated newscasts at 7 p.m. Central Time. Henry Frain is our technical director this afternoon for The Afternoon Magazine. The producer for The Afternoon Magazine is Harriet Williamson. Coming up in just a moment, we'll be back with Stephen Shaw, and we'll take your comments and questions about dining out at 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn, and we're back on the air with Stephen Shaw, author of Turning the Tables, Restaurants from the Inside Out. We're talking about dining out this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, you can join us with questions about dining out, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Stephen, hello.
Hi.
Hi. Let's keep
I hope
our
this is better.
Yeah, let's keep our fingers crossed. I think we'll be fine. Well, you were telling us about contemplating for about a minute and a half, studying to be a chef.
Well, you know, it's just not for me. It's the work is too hard. If I stand on a tile floor for 12 hours in a row, I have back pain for a week.
Yeah, and you did some time. You've done some time in the kitchen of a New York restaurant, and it is hard work. You wore your most comfortable shoes. It didn't help much.
No. When I worked on the book, I spent time in several different restaurant kitchens, and every time I went to a new kitchen, I would try a different pair of shoes. I tried my Timberland boots. I tried loafers. I tried clogs. Clogs are very popular among chefs, but they didn't do anything for me. Sneakers didn't work. Nothing really worked for me.
Yeah. What leads people to stick with it? It is such a hard business.
Well, I think that's the thing. You know, it's the people stick with it because they love it. And I think if more people realized that the people who cook in restaurant kitchens are doing it because they're in love with it, then maybe they would realize that, you know, it's not that they're making tons of money.
Yeah.
It's that they're really committed to the excellence of it.
Yeah. What were the first restaurants you reviewed, and how did you go about thinking, you know what I could write restaurant reviews?
Well, the first restaurants that I reviewed were ones that I ate at by happenstance when I was a lawyer. And my first job out of law school, I got a job as an associate at a large law firm in New York City, and one of the things they did was I ate out all the time. And so I was accumulating all these meals, which were being paid for by the firm. And one of the things I started doing on the side was writing about them. So it was sort of I was going down the list of all the best restaurants in New York, and I was eating at all of them. And what I was finding was that I didn't really necessarily agree with the evaluations of the professional critics. So I started writing my own and publishing them online.
Yeah. Do you still practice law?
No, no way. I mean, I recently defended my superintendent in traffic court, but, you know, I do little things like that. I write letters for my friends to their landlords, but no, I'm totally out of the legal business and writing full time.
Yeah, that's another hard career, isn't it?
Well, it is. It's something that I enjoy doing. I love to write, and for a long time it was a hobby. And anything that you do as a hobby, when it all of a sudden becomes a profession and you have to do it to pay the bills, that definitely takes a little bit of the love out of it. But nonetheless, I'm so much happier doing what I do now than I ever was practicing law that I would never complain.
Yeah. Well, describe the website for our listeners and EGCI.
Well, the website goes under the umbrella egullet.org or .com. You can get there either way. And what we are, a large organization that does a lot of stuff online about food. We have our biggest features. We have discussion forums where people join and they get into debates about restaurants, about the best way to cook something, about articles they read in the newspaper that they disagree with. But then we also have several features that are more heavily produced and edited. One of the things that we're particularly proud of is called the EGullet Culinary Institute, which is a grassroots advanced amateur learning program where people who are really good at something teach everybody else how to do it. So, like, we might have a member who's really great at barbecuing a whole pig. And so he'll do a whole clinic on it with photographs and everything, and he'll stay online for a couple of days so people can ask questions. And then we do all sorts of courses like this on everything from stock making to Indian food, and it's a big exchange of information.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Now, your early internet reviews received two important recognitions, one of them from a chef at one of your favorite restaurants. What was that tableside visit like from that chef?
Well, you know, it started off really great. It was my 30th birthday, and my wife had taken me to Gramercy Tavern in New York City for dinner, and the waiter somehow figured out, we had a very clever waiter who had been reading my stuff online, and he figured out from bits and pieces of conversation that it was me. And also my wife had asked for happy birthday, Stephen, on the dessert, and he came over and he said, "Hey, are you Stephen Shaw, the internet food guy?" And it was the first time I had ever been recognized anywhere. So to me, it was great. You know, I said, "Oh, my God, I'm like a minor celebrity now." And he said, "Oh, the chef is going to want to meet you. He reads your stuff, too." And so the chef came out, and it was this great moment. You know, the Tom Colicchio, the chef, and his chef's whites, and he's really good-looking, and all the women's heads were turning. And he came, and he crouched down at the table, and he said to me, "You know what's wrong with your writing? You have no idea what goes on in a restaurant kitchen."
Yeah.
So I was, you know, my face turned red, and I said to him, "Well, you know, what are you going to do about it?" And he said, "I'm going to order an extra, extra large chef's coat, and you're going to come in on Monday, and you're going to work, and you're going to see what it's really like." So I did that for a week. I worked in the kitchen there.
Yeah. What's it like in the kitchen there?
Well, it's amazing. The you know, I never imagined the seriousness and dedication to craftsmanship and hard work that go on in a place like that, and just how much work it is to make dishes that seem really simple, but actually the sauce took 3 days to make.
Yeah. What's it like when the orders begin to just pour into the kitchen?
Well, it's amazing. It's a sort of controlled chaos. You know, people... When people at the tables place orders, these days at modern restaurants, they get keyed into a computer, and then there's this little computer printer in the kitchen that starts printing up the orders. And when that thing really gets going, you might have 12 orders of lobster on one cook's station, and it really does get kind of crazy, but they manage to get through it at a kitchen where there's good teamwork. You know, if there's a lot of work in one part of the kitchen, somebody goes over there and helps out, and they make it work. At bad restaurants where they don't have a lot of teamwork, the customers just sit and wait.
Yeah. Now, you've also now spent time with farmers and fishermen and waitstaff. What have they taught you?
Well, you know, when I did the book, I wanted to make it clear that there's more to a restaurant than just what goes on in the kitchen and what goes on in the front of the house in service. And so I decided I wanted to work a little bit of time in sort of every position in the food service industry, from server to reservationist, taking reservations. I went out with farmers and fishermen and veal butchers in the Bronx. And what I learned was that this industry, the restaurant industry, which is the second largest employer in the United States after the government, is this incredibly complex interlocking system that, to me, is more impressive than putting a man on the moon.
Yeah, it is really, really something. Tell us about the New York restaurant 11 Madison Park and what you learned from your experience waiting tables.
Well, I did a couple of things at 11 Madison Park. I spent about a week working as a reservationist taking reservations, and then I spent time on the floor watching as the people who had made those reservations came in and actually ate and took their dinners to conclusion, and then I stayed around late at night as they counted up the money and split up the tips. So I got to see it all from start to finish, but basically what I learned in actually waiting on tables was just how bad I am at it. I mean, I can't even pour the water without dripping it all over the place. And so, you know, I used to get so annoyed when a drop of water would miss the glass, and now I realize, you know, that's not exactly the easiest thing to do when you're standing in a crowded restaurant with people jostling you.
Yeah. So has that experience changed you as a diner?
It has. I definitely acknowledge more the servers and cooks and everybody as fellow human beings who are working hard and doing a job. You know, there's a stereotype, and I used to buy into it, that servers in restaurants are transient employees. They're all just frustrated actors and models waiting for the next big thing. And that's not really true. There are plenty of career waiters who just do it because they love it. And there are even actors and models who nonetheless are very serious about the service profession. And so I definitely take the whole thing a lot more seriously. And I found that in and of itself gets me better service, because as soon as you start making eye contact and acknowledging these people as equals and fellow human beings, it creates this magical connection that really improves every meal.
Yeah, I think that's a really nice piece of advice that you offer us in the book, is to be genuine and treat everyone with respect, from the person you talk to about making a reservation all the way through the dining experience.
Yeah, and it's not a complicated piece of advice. It's easy to do. It's as simple as please and thank you. But so few people take the time to make that common sense effort.
Yeah. Sometimes I am so surprised when I sit down at a restaurant and the waiter comes to the table and says, "Good evening, how are you?" And I say, "I'm fine, thank you, how are you?" They're floored when I ask them how they are. You know, they're surprised. I was like, "Oh, well, thank you for asking. I'm fine." And we're off to a great start, you know, and it's really nice. And then if you keep going back to, you know, if you become a regular at a place, you know, you're well on your way to a nice relationship with the people who work there.
It's really true, and, you know, a lot of people, obviously, you know, every restaurant treats its regulars better, and you want to be a regular, but that can be an expensive proposition, of course.
Yeah.
You have to go many times. And one of the things I talk about in the book is what I call becoming a regular on your first visit. And it's exactly what you're talking about. It's just like a first date or a job interview. That first 2 or 3 minutes really sets the tone. And it can be something as straightforward as just responding to the how are you with a how are you of your own. And that can really get the ball rolling. Also just expressing genuine interest, really asking questions about the menu and listening to the answer. I can't tell you how many times I was in a kitchen while I was working on the book, and a server would come in and say, "Hey, you know, the people on table 33, they're in from Ohio. They're so nice. They're so excited to be here. Can't we do something special for them?" And those people weren't rich. They weren't going to leave a big tip, and they were never going to come back to the restaurant. But nonetheless, because they were nice and interested and genuine, the servers wanted to go out of their way to do something special for them.
Is that what you mean when you say in the book there are levels of regulars?
Well, yeah, it's exactly that.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Stephen Shaw. He is the founder of the website eGullet. He is the author of a new book about restaurants, Turning the Tables, Restaurants from the Inside Out. And one of his goals in writing the book, he says, if we have a better understanding of how restaurants work, we can also learn how better to enjoy dining in them. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions and comments about dining out. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. What makes a restaurant a good restaurant, and what makes a restaurant a great restaurant? I fear we've lost our phone connection again. Stephen Shaw, are you there? No, we're going to have to make that connection one more time. Things aren't going my way this afternoon. I know now what it's like to be maybe standing over a hot, hot stove in a restaurant kitchen somewhere. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area to call us this afternoon. If you'd like to talk with Stephen Shaw, we'll get him on back on the line here momentarily. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Stephen Shaw, the author of Turning the Tables, Restaurants from the Inside Out, the publisher, HarperCollins. I'm Celeste Quinn. Henry Frayne is our technical director this afternoon. The producer for the program is Harriet Williamson. And I'm told that Stephen is back with us, and we're going to get him on the line here just in one second. Okay. Hi, Stephen.
We're having this terrible rain and wind here, so I think
causing some
interruptions.
Yeah, that's all right. Everybody has an off night, right, in the restaurant business, and same thing happens in live radio. Now,
yeah, and this is the perfect day to make reservations when it's rainy and windy.
Yeah, that's a good thought.
Show up for their reservations.
Yeah, tell us about your theory or your idea of if you want to get into a place that you've been dying to try and it's really hard. You say pay attention to the weather is one thing. What else should you pay attention to?
Well, you want to do the opposite of what everyone else is doing. So if it's the Super Bowl, well, that's a great night to go out to any restaurant. If Monica Lewinsky is being interviewed on Oprah, that's a really good time for you to go and get restaurant reservations. And likewise, you know, everybody wants to go out Friday, Saturday night. Even if you can get a reservation on Friday or Saturday night, that's just not the most pleasant time to eat at a restaurant. But if you go on Tuesday night, you'll have the place to yourself, and you can have a much more enjoyable experience. And you can be remembered by the staff, and then you're on your way to becoming a regular.
Yeah. What about early diners, or early dining, or late dining?
Well, I love to eat early for a variety of reasons. One is that if you're in the first sitting, the restaurant is by definition empty when you get there, which means you have your choice of tables. You know, if they're taking you to one table but you want another one, it's very easy for them to switch you. And it's quiet, and you have the full attention of the wait staff during the process of ordering and settling in. And then as the restaurant starts to fill up, you know, you need less attention anyway, so the timing is perfect. The other reason I like to eat early is it's easier to get the reservations at those early times. So it's always a good move to take early reservations. Plus, who wants to go to sleep on a full stomach? I mean, these fancy restaurant meals are so big. Eating them at 9, 10 o'clock just seems crazy to me.
Yeah. What do you think about trying a great restaurant for lunch?
I think that's a great idea. There are all sorts of ways to get to know a restaurant that don't involve the investment of $100 or more per person for dinner. One way is lunch. Another way is in a lot of cities they have promotions, you know, in slow time during the summer. They might have a special fixed price meal that exposes you a little bit. Another fun thing to do is just go sit at the bar and order a couple of appetizers. You know, you have a glass of wine, a couple of appetizers, you might spend $30 or $40 instead of $100+, and you get to taste the restaurant's food, and you get to decide, you know, maybe are you going to go back for a real meal?
Yeah. Well, dining out is a luxury, and, you know, I love doing it occasionally. But then again, I do have to keep an eye on the tab, ultimately. When we go to a restaurant, what can we do to manage the bill that will come due?
Well, I think the first thing to do is to make sure you know the price of everything you're ordering. So, for example, when the wait staff recites the specials, I think it's important to ask how much the specials cost, because I can't tell you how many times people email me about this all the time. You know, they were in a restaurant, and every entree costs between $20 and $25, and they ordered a special, and the special is $40. So you always want to ask how much things cost. And then the other thing is you want to be really careful about adding on all those little extras, because they really add up. The bottled water, the coffee and tea and dessert wines and wines by the glass and cocktails. And when you add all those things in, they can easily double the bill or more. So, you know, if you're really on a budget, just stick to appetizer, entree, dessert, and tap water, and you can eat at a really good restaurant for a pretty reasonable price.
Yeah. What makes a restaurant a good restaurant? What makes a restaurant a great restaurant?
Well, I think it's that a really great restaurant goes beyond just the food. I mean, there are a lot of restaurants where you can go and get good food, but a really great restaurant is about the overall experience. It transcends just a really good plate of food. And so when you take together the service, the ambiance, the decor, the way that you interact and the way the menu changes with the seasons and all those things, they really add up to more than the sum of their parts, and that's really what makes a great restaurant.
Yeah. Well, in a great restaurant, tell us how they develop their menus. How do they get the produce, the meat, the fish, all the things that go into the menu? Where does that all come from? Who does the shopping? Where do they go?
Well, it's amazing, you know, that has changed so much in the last couple of decades. You know, it used to be that all that stuff came to every restaurant frozen on a truck. And now, in recent years, especially good restaurants, the restaurants are developing relationships specifically with the person who grows tomatoes and the person who grows greens and specific fishermen. There's a couple of restaurants in New York now where next to the fish it even says the name of the boat that they got it from. And that's maybe going a little bit too far, but they're really sourcing stuff differently now. And, you know, with the arrival of Federal Express, you can now get anything anywhere overnight. So for a restaurant to get a few pounds of some great fish from Alaska, they can get that from the dock to the table 24 hours later. So it's a whole new world of ingredients now.
Yeah. And with the ingredients, you know, when I go to shop, you know, some days the green beans look great and some days they look like they were run over by the truck before they were put on board. So given that, you know, some days some things look good and some days they look terrible, how do they cope with that?
Well, they have to be flexible. You know, the worst thing that a restaurant can do is promise its customers that they're going to have blackberries every day. You know, what they should be doing is they should be having some kind of fruit every day, but they should be able to have the flexibility to change that on the plate depending on what's good on what day. Once you start getting into having asparagus every day or having any particular bit of produce every day, you lock yourself into using bad produce if that's all that's available.
Mm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our guest today, Stephen Shaw, author of Turning the Tables, Restaurants from the Inside Out. Let's talk with a listener, a caller in Bloomington, Illinois, on line 4. Hi.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I had a question and comment. The comment was that when I lived in Iowa City, Iowa, I dined frequently at a place called Thai Flavors, and they really have a different business model. I would call them a philanthropic restaurant, and they once or twice a month they advertise the day, and on that day all profits made by the business are donated to a different charitable organization within the city, and they've sponsored a lot of really great things, and also use only olive oil, for instance, in their cooking, and are just really into the health of their customers as well as the societal health of the place where they live. And I was wondering if Mr. Shaw has any experience with this sort of organizational structure for restaurants.
Stephen?
Yes, well, I think that restaurants now are such an important part of the community that they're more than just businesses. I mean, people are going there as almost a substitute for the home kitchen. They're places where people meet. They're places where social interaction occurs. And as a result, they really play an important role in community building. And that can be anything from the simple act of opening a restaurant in a borderline neighborhood and helping to make that neighborhood better to actually giving money to charity, which a lot of restaurateurs do. The restaurant industry is great about giving to charity, to giving jobs, you know, to giving employment to marginal employees, and of course immigrants. You know, a lot of the immigrant population is employed in the restaurant business, and it's a way up into society, a way to learn the language, a way to learn skills. So there's a lot of that going on, and you'll also notice that, you know, when NPR does its fundraising drives, they get a lot of donated meals from restaurants that they can auction off and things like that. So it's really the industry has really come through, especially you look at in the wake of all these hurricanes, the number of events that the restaurant industry puts on, it totally outstrips what any other industry is doing.
Hmm. Does a listener want to follow up?
Yeah, I was also wondering what his thoughts are on the chain or franchise restaurants, one, just how their food is in general, and then second, what franchises are doing better in this respect and that we might want to support when we're given the options on the strip mall with all the different franchise restaurants available, what might be the more philanthropic choices. And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, good question.
Well, definitely the one that right now is doing a lot of great stuff is the Chipotle Grill, which is, you know, the biggest investor in Chipotle Grill happens to be McDonald's. And so it's a little bit of a disconnect because we think of McDonald's as sort of the stereotype of the sort of big, you know, food business, you know, without feelings. And yet Chipotle Grill, you know, they're using all sorts of organic stuff. They have very good employment practices. They're very plugged into the communities. And so, you know, it's sort of hard to generalize about these chains because even the same corporation could have a very thoughtful chain and a very thoughtless chain. But I definitely think Chipotle is one to look at. In terms of franchises in general, again, it's really hard to generalize. Some of those big chains do a really nice job, and some of them are terrible. You know, last month I was traveling a lot, and I ate a lot of them, and I had some really good meals at. I had a good meal at Cheesecake Factory. I had a good meal at Macaroni Grill. I had a terrible meal at Olive Garden. You know, it just really depends on which one it is, and some of them are doing a pretty good job. It's just like any other kind of restaurant. Some are good, some are bad.
Yeah. Do you think as we get better as diners, that is making the franchises serve us better? Are the menus improving as we get better and smarter as diners?
Absolutely they are. You know, everything is getting better in food in America because you look at the whole package of everything that's happening with improved shipping and agricultural methods, and you go into any supermarket now, you know, you go into the supermarkets in suburban Illinois where 20 years ago they had a very limited selection, and now they have Parmigiano Reggiano cheese, they have 18 kinds of extra virgin olive oil, they have wild salmon flown in from Alaska. So, you know, when that is all available to everybody, then, of course, people start demanding more when they go out to eat. And also people are watching the Food Network, they're reading more about food, they're talking about food online. So the food culture moves forward by leaps and bounds, and that definitely creates a demand for better food. I mean, that's why you have McDonald's investing in Chipotle Grill, because they know that that's the future.
Yeah. Well, I have noticed that the quality of the bread product or products and salads have really improved over the last couple of years.
Oh, yeah. Bread is a big one. You know, it used to be if you left the big cities, you just couldn't get any decent bread. And now you go to Costco, you go to any of these big supermarket chains, you know, they're baking bread on premises and they're doing a pretty good job. And then you have these chains like Panera Bread where they're everywhere and they're doing really quite good bread.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, food writer Stephen Shaw. He's the author of Turning the Tables, Restaurants from the Inside Out. We've got about 10 minutes left in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine, and if you'd like to join us with a question or a comment, give us a call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. You mentioned that you travel a lot, and I imagine that you get to Chicago quite often. Now, Chicago, as you mentioned in Turning the Tables, has like 6,000 restaurants.
Yeah, it's a big city.
So, a couple of questions here. Where do you like to eat in Chicago? And when you come across a restaurant that's new to you, what leads you through the doors and gets you to sit down?
Well, you know, any place I go, I like to eat at the places where they don't have that place anywhere else. So, you know, I generally avoid the steakhouses and the things that are replicated all over the place, and I focus on what's unique and local. Now, of course, Chicago has this great local food culture, and a lot of it is the kind of fast food, the hot dogs, the Italian beef sandwiches. So I love to eat a lot of that stuff. And then the other thing that I think is really great in Chicago is that Chicago right now has probably the most cutting-edge, avant-garde, inventive, creative restaurants in the country. It's economically it's hard to open a really radical, inventive place in a market like New York City because it's very expensive and you're taking a lot of risk. Chicago is the perfect size that they have an educated culinary population, but the rents are cheaper. So you have restaurants like Alinea and Moto, and, of course, Charlie Trotter's, where they're able to really create and do some interesting stuff. So those are the places that I gravitate towards when I'm there.
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener. This is a caller in Terre Haute, Indiana, line 4. Go ahead.
Hello?
Hi there.
Hi. I'm calling about the issue of smoking in restaurants. Now, if you're in New York City or California, and many cities across the country, this is not a problem. But certainly in Terre Haute, Indiana, it's a problem. And although we don't have a lot of upscale restaurants, we do eat out a lot. How do you speak to the issue of smoking in restaurants? And I'm not satisfied with non-smoking areas generally or even with ventilated smoking areas.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's, cigarette smoke and great food do not mix. I was just recently in North Carolina and Virginia where people, where of course the tobacco industry is very powerful in those places, so they're not about to ban smoking in restaurants, and it really does interfere with your enjoyment of the meal. Even if you're in the non-smoking section, the smoke gets over to you. Now, you know, aside from politics, and I'm not making a political statement here, if people want to smoke, that's fine with me, but in restaurants where you're eating food, the smoke so directly impacts your ability to taste the food. I really wish that more restaurant owners would take it upon themselves to say, this is a smoke-free establishment, and I think there are plenty of people who will support that from a commercial perspective.
And the position of the staff that has to be around it the entire time, I don't think that's political. That's just a health issue. But I appreciate your comment about how it ruins the dining experience. I wish more restaurant owners would realize that. I wish more public officials would realize that to ban smoking is really to support health. Well, thanks for your comment.
Thanks for the call. I think the trend definitely is smoke-free, isn't it?
Oh yeah, well, more and more states are doing it, but it's been a it's been a long battle, and it's going to go on for a long time still. I don't think you're going to see smoking outlawed in restaurants in North Carolina and Virginia until the year 2020
yeah.
or something.
Yeah, and here in the Midwest, in diners and things. I mean, I don't see that in the near future unless it becomes a local ordinance, but. That's in our community, that's been kind of tough sledding so far.
Yeah, well, you never know what issues are going to turn up, and the insurance companies might start insisting on it. There could be reasons that could accelerate the process, but yeah, I think it's, especially in bars, smoking is such an element of the bar scene, and a lot of people eat in bars, and it's tough to unravel all those threads.
Yeah. When you have a complaint at a restaurant, when something is amiss, the wine is bad, for instance, how do you handle the situation?
Well, people are just too reluctant to speak up in restaurants, and as a result, they're not sticking up for themselves. And I think that's because psychologically people learn at a young age, that when you're a guest in someone's home, you don't complain about anything. But what people have to understand is that when you're in a restaurant, you're not a guest. Yes, you should be polite, but you're a customer. You're paying for this experience, and it should please you. So definitely, whenever there's anything wrong, you want to speak up about it. Now, the best way to do that is to be constructive. Take your complaint directly to a manager, because servers don't necessarily have the ability to do very much with your complaints. And also, if you're embarrassed about complaining in front of the people at your table, just get up as though you're going to the restroom, excuse yourself from the table, walk around the corner, find a manager and say, hey, hey, pal, can you give me a hand here? I'm having a problem. And I guarantee you that problem is going to be addressed in any good restaurant.
Yeah, yeah. When is it okay to ask for something special? Say, instead of asparagus, may I have the spinach?
Well, it really depends on the restaurant and on what you're asking for. At a very nice restaurant, you should be able to ask for a lot. I mean, you can't ask to have grain number 5 taken out of the 7-grain bread. That's just basically impossible, right? But you can ask definitely for sauce on the side. You can ask for adjustments to preparation. In a restaurant that's a little bit lower down in the pecking order, where a lot of stuff is pre-prepared and they're doing a lot of volume and they don't have the staff to really make a lot of custom alterations, you have to adjust your expectations appropriately and not be disappointed when they tell you, actually, this particular item is pre-made, so
yeah.
No, we can't take an ingredient out of it.
Yeah. One of my pet peeves is being rushed. You barely finish a first course and they're on top of you with the main course.
Yeah.
Should you take care of that at the outset, or how do you handle that one?
Yeah, pacing is so important to enjoyment of a meal. And I think, the second you detect that they're rushing you, you want to say, hey, look, we've got plenty of time. We're not going anywhere. We'd love to enjoy a nice leisurely meal. If you could let the kitchen know that would be great. On the other hand, also, if you have to be somewhere at 8 o'clock, be sure you tell them that. Because the last thing that you want to happen is at 7:50 to say, oh, no, we got to get our dessert, we got to get our check. Say it when you come into the restaurant at 6 o'clock, we have to be out by 8 so that they can process that.
Yeah, maybe even say that up front when you make the reservation.
Sure, the more information you can give when you make the reservation, the better. When you're making a reservation, if you've been to the restaurant before, ask for a table that you like. They'll probably give it to you. They'll tell you they can't guarantee it, but they'll almost always give you the table you want. If it's a birthday, tell them it's a birthday. Mm. If you've been there before, be sure to let them know that you've been there before, and always use the same phone number every time you make a reservation, because that's how they index you in their computer system.
Isn't that amazing? They know who you are. Right?
Yeah.
When you're calling in. And if they don't, if the restaurant doesn't have that kind of a sophisticated reservation system, but they're a great restaurant or a very good restaurant, you can say, we dined here with you a week ago or a month ago, and we really enjoyed the experience, and we're looking forward to coming back.
Absolutely. That's going to get a little star next to your name in the reservation book, and that's what you want.
Yeah, brownie points are good. What are your plans for Thanksgiving, Stephen?
Well, first I'm going to my mother's.
Uh-huh.
My mother lives right across town. And then I'm going over to, we have some friends, so we're going to have the nighttime dinner with them. So we're doing double Thanksgiving dinners. The thing about having family in New York is I never get to eat at restaurants for Thanksgiving. One year I'd love to do that because I don't even know what happens.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't know. Home cooking has a lot to recommend it as well. So
yeah, well, it's just a lot of people are always asking me. I'm coming to town. What restaurant should I go to for Thanksgiving? I'd love to be able to answer them.
Yeah, yeah. What are your favorites in New York City before we have to go?
Well, I, of course, I love all the favorites that everybody else loves. The great restaurants like Le Bernardin and Jean George, and those are all great. But in terms of personal favorites, right now the place I've been eating at a lot is this new restaurant, The Modern, which is in the Museum of Modern Art. It's owned by the same people who own Union Square Cafe and Gramercy Tavern. And they built this beautiful restaurant in the Museum of Modern Art that overlooks the Sculpture Garden.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just one of the most wonderful places to be. And the great thing is that they offer really good value in their cafe. The dishes are not expensive, $12 to $15 for a plate. And you get two or three plates, and it's a really nice lunch in one of the most beautiful settings. So that's sort of my new favorite. And then I also spend a lot of my recreational eating time eating in Chinatown because I love Asian food. I love going to new places that I've never been to before. So, you know, sometimes just go down to Chinatown and pick a place.
Okay. There we have to leave it. Stephen, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
Stephen Shaw has been our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of Turning the Tables, Restaurants from the Inside Out. The book is published by HarperCollins. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, settlement prices should begin from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Celeste. From the Board of Trade this afternoon, futures finished mostly unchanged. In fact, a lot of zeros on the board today. Every corn contract that we follow from December of this year to December of next year, unchanged for the day. All had zeros. We'll get to those numbers in just a moment. Three of the bean contracts were unchanged today as well. December contract in the wheat pit. Soft red winter wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade had a high today of 302, a low at 295 and a quarter. Fairly wide trading range, if you give in this day anyway. A 297 settlement price. They were down a penny and a half today for that Dease wheat contract. The March futures 316, the high, the low at 311. Settlement price at 312 and three quarters off a half. And the May contract down a penny at 321 and three quarters in the wheat pit. 323 and three quarters the high, the low at $3.20 for the May soft red winter wheat. July futures 333 and a half, the high, the low at 329. The harvest month settled for the wheat at 330 and three quarters at the Board of Trade. They were off a half today. September futures down three quarters, 339 and a quarter at the settlement price, the high at 40 and a half, the low at 38 and one half. From the corn pit, December contract unchanged today, 192 and a half the high. The low at $1.91 and a quarter, that lead option at 191 and a half, once again unchanged, the low at 191 and one quarter. March contract unchanged, 206 the high, the low at 4 and 3 quarters. Settlement price at 205 and a quarter for the March futures in the corn pit. And the May futures at 214 and a quarter high, low at 213 and a quarter. Like the rest of the futures, unchanged today, 213 and a half. July futures in the corn pit, $2.22 the high, the low at 221 and a quarter. Settlement price at 222 and rather 221 and a quarter. Down on that low for the July corn, they were unchanged. And the September futures at 230 and a quarter. Settlement price unchanged today. They had a high of 230 and three quarters, a low at 230 and a quarter. And the December contract for next year, 241 and a half the high, the low at 240 and three quarters, settlement price at 241 even. December corn 2006, unchanged. Dease oats, 176 the high, the low at 171. Settlement price for the December oat contract at 175 and three quarters, up five and a quarter today. The March futures were up three and a half. They finished at $1.82 and a quarter. Soy complex now unchanged on the day in nearby January's 576 the high, the low at 571 and a quarter. Unchanged for the day at 572 and a quarter for the January futures in the bean pit. March contract, 583 and three quarters the high. Low at 579, settlement price at $5.80. They were up a quarter. And the May, 589, the high, the low at 585, settlement price at 586 and a quarter, up one. July futures, 594 and three quarters the high, the low at 590, settlement price at 591 and a quarter. They were unchanged. And the August contract, 595 and a half the high, the low at 593, settlement price at $5.93 and a half, unchanged for the day. September futures, 595 the high, the low at 592. a settlement price at $5.92. They were down 3/4 for the day. Soy complex now, November beans next year, $6 the high, the low at 5.96 and a half, settlement price at 5.96 and 3/4, and they were off a penny and a half for the day. Soybean meal from the products, 1.75 the high, the low at 1.73.30 for the December, settlement price at 1.73.60. They were down 30. January's unchanged at 174.90 for the bean meal contract today. December bean oil, 22.05 the high, the low at 21.85, settlement price at 21.98, up a nickel, and January futures were unchanged in the bean oil pit today at the Chicago Board of Trade at $22.13. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Okay, Todd. Well, for the first time in a few days now, we have higher prices today on the Mercantile Exchange.
The Carle Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carle Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
January feeder cattle, today's high 113.35, the low 112.60, the settlement 113.17 and a half, that up 50. March 111.60, the high 110.70, the low, the settlement 111.52 and a half, that up 45. April 110.30, the high 109.80, the low 110.20, the settlement, that up 27 and a half. December live cattle 91.10, the high 90.40, the low 91.02 and a half, the settlement, that up 70. February 93.55, the high 92.70, the low 93.50, the settlement, that up 75. December lean hog 61.40, the high 60.80, the low 61.32 and a half, the settlement, that up 67 and a half. February 65.45, the high 64.85, the low, the settlement 65.37 and a half, that up 75. April 67.40, the high 66.55, the low, finishing at 67.32 and a half, that up 75. And May lean hog 68.85, the high 68.50, the low 68.72 and a half, the settlement, that finished up 32 and a half. February pork bellies, today's high 89.20, the low 86.75, the settlement 88.22 and a half, that up 147 and a half. The Dow up 41 points at 10,861, the NASDAQ 13 higher at 22.54, the S&P 500 up 5 points at 1260.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
In the weather, there is a lake effect snow watch in effect for LaPorte, St. Joseph, Elkhart, Marshall, and Kosciusko counties in northern Indiana for late Wednesday night, tomorrow night, through Friday afternoon, for the potential of some locations receiving over a foot of snow. Ed Kieser's forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon. In Illinois, mostly sunny. In west central and southwestern Indiana, look for a mix of clouds and sunshine. In northern and eastern Indiana, mostly cloudy with some lake effect snow showers near Lake Michigan. Highs from 35 in northern Illinois to 48 in the far south. Tonight in northern and east central Illinois and in western Indiana, increasing cloudiness with some snow and rain showers arriving overnight. In west central and southern